I would like to welcome to the club the most recent Patreon supporters, Catherine D., Jennifer M., Joe A.W., Lauren Z., The Inkling Girl, who is an incredibly talented artist, Amber M., The All Crime No Cattle Podcast, Derek S., and Carrie S. Thank you so much for your support. I just want to keep you up to date on some of the things I have going on in the next few months. On March 30th, 2019, I will be hosting the Texas Podcasters Union at The Yard in Fort Worth, Texas. It's a really cool food truck yard where you can bring your furry little friends to meet all of your favorite podcasters. I will be there along with All Crime No Cattle, and I think there's going to be an out-of-town podcaster joining us as well. Head to the True Crime Fan Club Facebook page, click on events for more information. I am excited to announce that True Crime Fan Club is going to be attending the first annual True Crime Podcast Festival on July 13th, 2019 in Chicago. The festival is specifically designed around your desire to mingle, interact, and have casual conversations with the podcasters you listen to regularly. There will also be panel discussions and live episode recordings. Some of the shows registered are The Trail Went Cold, Crawl Space, and the Canadian True Crime Podcast. You won't want to miss this. Go to the website tcpf2019.com to find information on tickets and the hotel. Prices do go up the closer we get to the event, so you won't want to wait. When you buy your ticket, make sure you mention True Crime Fan Club on the ticket registration survey, and I'll see you at the True Crime Podcast Festival. Now, I normally introduce my listeners to new podcasts at the end of the show, but this is one podcast I don't want you to miss out on. So check out the Rusty Hinges podcast. I'm going to be playing their promo so you can get a taste of the show format. Be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review on Apple Podcasts.
The world can be a mysterious place. It can also be a boring place. So let's focus on the mysterious. Rusty Hinges is a podcast that explores mysteries, hoaxes, natural phenomena, and weird history. Basically, anything that's a bit, well, hinky. Season 1 topics include the tale of Clarence Roberts, a man who died more than once. And then there is the maybe kidnapping of June Robles, the sun that danced in the sky over Portugal, and an unsolved murder on the high seas. Rusty Hinges is generally skeptical, but never dismissive. Well, usually not dismissive. You can find Rusty Hinges on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. That's Rusty Hinges. R-U-S-T. You know what? I have faith in your spelling abilities, so go and subscribe to Rusty Hinges and maybe you'll solve a mystery. Probably not, but, you know, you never know.
Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. On the south side of Houston lies a neighborhood called Acres Homes. Acres Homes sits on approximately 9 square miles. Acres Homes was established during World War I and had initially been a thriving neighborhood, with each home sitting on an acre of land. As the city grew, however, the neighborhood became the poster child for neglect, until three different criminals decided to use it for their violent crimes. Okay, on to the show. In February 2006, Dorcas Shorten was working in the Sex Crimes Division of the Houston Police Department. The Houston PD Sex Crime Unit received 1,700 reports of sex crimes annually. In total, there were 12 members to oversee the Sex Crimes Unit. As you can imagine, it was difficult to prosecute cases based on the sex worker's testimony alone. Shorten was a diminutive 5 foot tall, 125 pounds, always dressed in a business suit with tasteful jewelry, and so soft-spoken, her colleagues often had to lean in to hear her in meetings. Shorten grew up in Houston to a father who worked for a plastics company and a mother who ran a small daycare. She majored in nursing at Prairie View A&M, but loved the law, so left school to become a Houston police officer. She started in patrol, then worked accident investigations, juvenile crime, and as a decoy sex worker in Vice. In 1996, she became an investigator and was eventually assigned to the Sex Crimes Unit. She always remembered her nights on the streets as a pretend sex worker. She had her fellow officers just a few feet away to protect her, but real sex workers did not. On February 28, 2006, Shorten was assigned a case involving Andrea, a 43-year-old sex worker. She had made a complaint that a short, stout black man abducted her at knife point and drove her behind the New Macedonia Missionary Baptist Church in Acres Homes. The man had raped her repeatedly and then pushed her out of the vehicle. He ordered her to face the wall of the church until he drove away. Shorten called the number Andrea had given police. Andrea's sister answered and disgustedly said she didn't know Andrea's whereabouts. Shorten mailed a letter to the address Andrea provided, but it was returned. The case was then placed in the inactive file. Less than a month later, on March 21st, Shorten caught a complaint from a 49-year-old sex worker named Joe. Joe reported to an officer that a stocky black man had invited her into his dark four-door car and driven her behind the Pine Grove Church of God in Christ in Acres Homes. The man suddenly turned violent, pulled a knife out, and forced her to perform oral sex. While she performed oral sex on him, he shouted, "Bitch, you better not black out," then pushed her out of the car. Just like with Andrea, Shorten called the number Joe had left, but reached Joe's father, who said she was in jail last time he had heard from her. Shorten sent a letter, but it was returned. However, Shorten realized there was a connection between the two cases and checked out a Ford Taurus to make the drive to Acres Homes. Acres Homes had 10-foot ditches lining the narrow roads rather than curbs and sidewalks and several empty lots. Many of them were full of trash or old tires. Ramshackle shotgun homes and tiny forlorn apartments made up the housing in Acres Homes. A once cheery but now dull and nearly illegible sign hung on one of the main boulevards and read, "Acres Homes, a people-building community." On West Montgomery, the neighborhood's main business strip, struggling mom-and-pop shops, liquor stores, and by-the-hour cheap motels were the area's mainstays. West Montgomery's main business, however, were sex workers and drug dealers. Shorten made her way down West Montgomery and talked to several sex workers who were out and about, most of whom were crack addicts. Their rates were as low as $20 for oral sex and $25 for intercourse, and as soon as they were paid, they went to a crack house to get high. As soon as their buzz was gone, they would hit the streets again to find another client. Shorten attempted to establish a relationship between the sex workers and the police, but they were really hesitant. 2 weeks after Shorten's disappointing visit to Acres Homes on April 2, 2006, a trail of blood was discovered at the Pine Grove Church. The blood started at a lone sandal lying in the parking lot. A deacon and the minister followed the trail of blood to some bushes. There, they found a woman on the ground with her face cradled in her arms. She appeared to be asleep. However, as the faint strains of uplifting gospel wafted through the air, one of the men attempted to wake the woman. The woman, Pamela Goss, was dead. She had been brutally attacked and stabbed over 54 times. Pamela was a 50-year-old sex worker, but unlike most others, she was married and lived in a house in the neighborhood. She sat by herself in this house most days, writing poetry and drawing. The press were somewhat dismissive of this homicide, writing a mere 4 paragraphs on her murder. However, the Houston PD was on high alert. When Shorten arrived to work that morning, a homicide detective was waiting for her. He had caught the case and immediately cross-referenced it with any other crimes in the area. That day, Shorten picked up her son at daycare after work, but immediately dropped him off at her parents' so she could go back to West Montgomery and canvass the sex workers. She begged them to talk, explaining to them, "You're victims here, just like anyone else." One woman finally relented and began relating a story to Shorten about a man who took her behind a church. He was pleasant initially, but suddenly his tone completely changed. He went on a rampage and pulled out a large butcher's knife from under the driver's seat. The man then forced her to perform oral sex. After this victim told this story, other women began opening up to Shorten. One problem existed, however. The descriptions of the suspect were inconsistent. Shorten decided this was because of the various women's crack addictions, or because there were so many men in between the assaults and the time they related the crime to Shorten. Some said the man was bald. Others said he had short hair. Some said he drove a four-door car, others said it was a red pickup with a sticker of a superhero, possibly Superman, on the back glass. 29-year-old Amanda told Shorten her church attacker had a tattoo on his left forearm that looked like the zodiac sign for Libra, or balanced scales. Shorten took Amanda to her office to get a statement from her. Amanda was rail thin and she desperately needed a shower. She had been wearing the same clothes for days and they reeked. Shorten bought Amanda a Big Mac and Amanda inhaled it and promptly fell asleep on Shorten's floor. When Amanda woke, she asked Shorten, "Why are you being so nice to me?" Shorten's mind flashed back to her days as a decoy sex worker and how vulnerable Amanda and others like her were. Not long after Shorten met with Amanda, homicide investigators found a case in the database that was seemingly related. The nude body of a 21-year-old sex worker was found in January, 3 months before the murder of Pamela Goss. Jasmine Clark, also known as Precious on West Montgomery, was lying in a field almost directly between the New Macedonia and Pine Grove churches. There were no signs of violence, so the death was ruled as an accidental overdose based on the amount of crack cocaine found in her system. Shorten looked at the location where Precious's body was found and did not believe that she would have walked naked across a deep ditch into the field on such a cold night. Shorten believed she had been placed there. Vanessa Franklin, a 45-year-old sex worker, was found the same month as Precious, 8 miles away from Acres' home, but her body was found near the new Mount Calvary Church. Her autopsy revealed she died from blunt force trauma and strangulation. On June 24, 2006, Patricia Duffy Garcia, a 42-year-old mother and grandmother, as well as a veteran sex worker, was dumped next to a private dirt road that was named Jesus Street. There was also a hand-painted sign by the road that read, "Church of God Property. Please, no dumping." On June 26, 2006, the skeletal remains of a woman were found by a construction worker, but there's no location. These remains were eventually identified to be 31-year-old sex worker Lisa Holland from Acres Homes. On July 19, 2006, children were running behind Parlay Cafe and stumbled across the body of Lakita Stubblefield, a 21-year-old sex worker. When she was a teenager, before she began taking drugs, she told her family she wanted to be a beautician and eventually own her own salon. "Just to bring you back, in the span of 6 months, there had been 6 dead sex workers found, 5 of them in Acres Homes. At least a dozen sex workers had related to Shorten that they had been assaulted behind churches in Acres Homes." The media had not picked up on any of the homicides, so no one outside the neighborhood knew what was happening. For that matter, Acres Homes residents did not really know that much either. Because these crimes were occurring to sex workers, families did not want to admit that their daughters were involved, so families were not talking to the press or holding candlelight vigils. One woman's parents were so ashamed about having a daughter who was a sex worker that they did not even claim the body, and instead let her be buried in the county's pauper cemetery. A press conference was held on July 20, 2006, and a crude composite sketch was provided. Homicide Captain Dale Brown stated, "We have a very dangerous person in our city. We need the whole city to be vigilant." The community was outraged and speculated that the police would have been more engaged if the victims were turning up in a wealthy white neighborhood. Pastor Chris Wright of Grace Temple Ministries said, quote, "I feel violated. We are being dumped on, and who cares, because the victims are black." Some Acres Homes women were so terrified that they stopped going out at night, while others stopped attending church services, fearing the killer was on the church grounds. One woman even kept a hatchet beside her locked door. Sadly, sex workers still went out after dark because they had to continue to work and support themselves. Shorten gave copies of the composite drawing to women working on West Montgomery. The sex workers had started calling her Miss Shorten and had become more comfortable with her because she was there so much. She would tell them, "Come on now, you don't have to get in a car with a man who looks like this." Sadly, one woman said, "Miss Shorten, if the serial killer gets us, he gets us." The Gulf Coast Violent Offenders Task Force was created to find the killer. More than a dozen homicide and sex crimes investigators were assigned to work full-time on the case. Shorten was teamed with 55-year-old Steven Strotter, a veteran homicide detective. They were a striking pair. Strotter was 6'1" and 230 pounds compared to Shorten's tiny stature. They had previously worked together when Shorten was in Vice. They both had a very firm grasp of the geography of Acres Homes and kept their eyes on the worst parts. They checked on sex offenders, followed up on multiple Crime Stoppers tips, and tracked down men who were threatening or denigrating sex workers, known wife beaters, or men who had Libra tattoos. All detectives on the task force carried small DNA kits with them and asked the men they interviewed for permission to test. They had evidence to test against. Pamela Goss had been found with semen in her mouth. Medical examiners believe she had been killed immediately after the killer ejaculated. Approximately 40 men consented to the test, and none of them were matches. The two detectives would go to a Luby's cafeteria near Acres Homes, where Shorten would say grace before they began eating. As they ate, they would try to create the most logical scenarios as to who the killer was. They just could not come up with any identifying information to help break the case. In August 2006, the pair received their first break. A witness, April, had just been arrested and charged with prostitution. She told the arresting officers and the jail staff that she had information about the murders. The detectives went to the jail to see her. She related a familiar story about a black man in a red pickup who took her to a church in Acres Homes, then forced her to have sex at knife point. At this point, April dropped a bombshell. She had gotten a look at the license plate of the truck and had written this number down on the wall of a seedy motel room. Unfortunately, it had been weeks since she had written down the number, so Strotter was concerned the number would be gone. However, April told them where to go, and when they got there, to their surprise and delight, the number was on the wall, right where she said it would be. The truck was registered to a 35-year-old Bilford Junius. There was a Superman sticker in the back window. Junius was 5'8", stout, and had a shaved head. He had grown up in Acres Homes and had moved just a few miles away from his old neighborhood. He held two jobs. By day, he worked at a cold storage unit, and at night, he worked at Domino's. He also coached a youth football team in his spare time. Junius had a clean criminal history. He had recently separated from his wife, who said he was not violent and definitely not a predator. However, when Shorten did a photo lineup for the sex workers and included his picture, several sex workers selected him and said he was their rapist. Some of the women even started sobbing and trembling. Junius was arrested and a court order was issued to take his DNA. His DNA matched that of a rape victim from 2003 and several of the sex workers who had been swabbed after having been attacked behind a church. Shorten and Strotter were convinced they had solved the case, but this confidence was quickly dashed. Junius's DNA did not match any of the semen found on the murdered sex workers. The detectives realized, with horror, that they had a serial rapist and a serial killer working Acres Homes at the same time. These two had been committing their crimes at the same churches.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Months after Junius was arrested, the task force was disbanded because the detectives were needed to work other homicides and sex crimes in the city. Shorten and Strotter were left to work on the case full-time. They had cameras installed around the churches and in the parking lots, and they continued to patrol Acres Homes. The pair made numerous other arrests for other crimes. They arrested a private security guard who beat up a sex worker. They took a young man into custody because he chased a sex worker with a butcher knife because they had taken $75 from him. They arrested an older man who was having sex with a 13-year-old. They also helped a woman leave an abusive boyfriend. But for all these successes, they were no closer to finding the killer. Sex workers teased them by saying, "Y'all might as well go home. The pair were so dedicated to finding the killers of the sex workers that they placed pictures of the victims in their cubicles. They searched reports of other attacks on sex workers to see if the killer had changed locations. They also read through missing persons reports to see if anything stood out. In September 2007, 14 months after the last victim was found, the naked body of 18-year-old Willie Bianca Jones was found. She had been dumped in a pile of trash in Acres Homes, down the street from the Blue Magic Lounge, a beer joint where she had been the night before. Understandably, the neighborhood, thinking the murders had stopped, panicked. They demanded to know why they had been abandoned. Volunteers cleaned empty lots where they were afraid bodies could be dumped. Jones lived with her infant daughter and mother in a low-income apartment in the Greens Point area, 10 minutes away from Acres Homes. While Jones worked the sex trade, her mother watched the baby. Shorten and Slaughter went to the apartment complex where they lived and asked around about Jones. A man looked at them and said, No, you must be here about Candace, the prostitute who was thrown under the bridge. He had been talking to a man called Baby Boy, who had said he had picked up a sex worker named Candace, fighting with her, and ultimately dumping her body under a bridge. Shorten and Slaughter went back to the records and found out that Candace Douglas had been found 3 months earlier on an embankment under a bridge just outside the Houston city limits in Harris County. Her shirt was on backwards, leading them to believe someone else had redressed her clumsily. There were no clear signs of murder, so her cause of death was listed as an accidental overdose. Another man from Jones's complex called Crime Stoppers a few weeks later. He also started talking about this man nicknamed Baby Boy, who had told him about cruising through a well-known sex trade spot in northern Houston. He met a woman and assaulted her until she was unconscious and threw her into the trunk of the car. Baby Boy picked up his girlfriend, but while she was in the car, the woman in the trunk regained consciousness and started kicking in the trunk. Baby Boy turned up the radio to drown out that noise and then dropped off his girlfriend. He took the sex worker to a quiet road, pulled her out of the car, stabbed her, and set her on fire. When Shorten and Strotter looked at the records again, they found that just a few weeks earlier, Candace Hightower Sharp, a 25-year-old sex worker who was a pastor's daughter from Huntsville, was found burned and stabbed to death outside of the city limits. Candace Hightower Sharp was the daughter of Moses and Elaine Hightower. She had three small children, ages 3, 5, and 7. Her cousin, Shaw James, said that Candace was in a very abusive marriage, and between that and the drugs, Candace just wasn't the same. Candace had spent some time in rehab in San Antonio, Texas, but did not complete the program. They also found a 32-year-old male who lived at Jones's apartment complex who used the moniker Baby Boy, Brian Renard Davis. Unlike Junius, David did have a lengthy criminal record for DWI, forgery, aggravated robbery, and aggravated sexual assault. The last charge of aggravated sexual assault came from an ex-girlfriend. She alleged that Davis punched her and kicked her, bound her ankles and wrists, gagged her with a bandana, raped her, and then told her, "It's up to you if you live or die." Shorten and Strotter got a search warrant for the car Davis had been driving and found blood in the trunk. Unfortunately, due to the FBI backlog, the sample was not analyzed until April 2008. When it was analyzed, the news was good. The blood contained Hightower's DNA. Davis was finally arrested, and the pair of detectives were convinced that this was their serial murderer. To their shock, Shorten received another call from the FBI agent a few days later. "I hate to tell you this, but Brian Davis's DNA isn't on any of the other victims, including Willie Jones." Shorten could not believe what she had just heard, so she had to have the agent repeat himself. Brian Davis was arrested for the murder of Candace in April 2008. Just 2 months after Davis was arrested, the murder of another sex worker occurred. In June 2008, Portia Turner was found in a field about 5 miles northeast of Acres Homes. She had been stabbed to death, but apparently tried to defend herself. One of her press-on fingernails was torn off, and an earring was ripped from her ear. But Shorten and Strotter could not find anyone who knew anything or had any information to offer about who could have done this to Turner. For 10 months, the two detectives read reports and talked to sex workers all over Houston,
to see if anyone had seen anything unusual, but could not come up with anything. Whoever was murdering the women was covering his tracks very well. They speculated and threw around several theories, like he had been arrested for a different crime, he had died, or he was in what the FBI called a cooling-off period. In April 2009, a year after Davis was arrested, a police officer came across a woman, naked and sobbing, in the same field where Turner had been found. The woman was 38-year-old Cynthiana, who had never been a sex worker. She lived with her boyfriend not far from where she was attacked. She told Shorten that she had accepted a ride home from a stout black man with short dreadlocks. He had been pleasant initially, then pulled out a knife and assaulted her. He then pushed her out of his car, an older four-door vehicle. In July 2009, a sex worker reported to police that a black man with dreads had picked her up on Airline Drive in Houston. He had been driving a two-door sports car. He had driven her to a remote street several miles away, then pointed a gun at her and bound her hands behind her back, raping her several times. He warned her that if she told anyone, he would find her, cut off her hands and feet, and then feed her to the alligators. There were similarities to Cynthiana's case, but some differences as well. Shorten and Strotter weren't sure if these were the same killer or two different men. In September 2009, in the Trinity Houston Gardens neighborhood, a nude woman ran out of a field and began banging on the doors of several homes seeking help. The woman was 18-year-old Chelsea, a sex worker. She had been working Airline Drive when a heavyset man with dreads pulled up in a two-door sports car, pointed a gun at her, and said he would kill her if she didn't get in the car. He drove her to a field in northeast Houston, tied her hands with a restaurant apron, and raped her. But he had gotten his car stuck in the mud, and so he stuffed Chelsea in the trunk and walked away to get help. She kicked her way out through the back seat and ran to a nearby neighborhood where she banged on two doors, screaming for help, to no avail. The third door, belonging to Jacqueline Hargrove, produced results. Hargrove contacted the police and did not answer the door to Chelsea, but as the police arrived, opened the door to speak to her. Chelsea said she needed help and that a man had tied her up and was trying to be forced to do something she didn't want to do. The officers drove Chelsea to a field where they found a Pontiac Grand Am with temporary plates, along with a driver. He was 38-year-old LaMarquez McWilliams. He had been raised in Acres Homes and currently lived with his 25-year-old girlfriend and her two small children in an apartment on the east side. He worked two jobs, the early shift at Whataburger and the evening shift at Papacito's, which was the apron he used to bind Chelsea's hands. McWilliams had a criminal record, misdemeanor assault charges, arrest for driving with a suspended license, felony charge for injury, and just a few months earlier, he had been arrested for possession of marijuana and paraphernalia when he was found with a pipe containing cocaine residue. McWilliams told officers on the scene that Chelsea had agreed to have sex with him for free and denied putting her in the trunk. While talking to him, an investigator noticed a tattoo on McWilliams' arm that looked like a Libra sign, but newer tattoos had been added around it. The investigator immediately contacted Shorten. Shorten and Strotter spoke to McWilliams' girlfriend, who said he was a kind and gentle lover. He was described as a hard worker and a chick magnet who did not need to seek out sex workers for sex. McWilliams seemed to be hiding something other than his tattoo. In every mugshot he had a different hairstyle. During his arrest, a DNA sample was taken. An FBI technician called a few days after his arrest and informed them that McWilliams' DNA matched that of the semen found in the mouth of Pamela Goss. His DNA also matched semen found in Precious Clark, semen found on a sweater belonging to Judy, a sex worker assaulted in 2006, and semen found in a 13-year-old Acres Homes girl who had been raped in 1996. McWilliams had been preying on Acres Homes women for at least 13 years. Shorten had McWilliams brought into an interview room where he stated he was innocent. All he wanted was to own his own trucking company so he would never do something like this. Shorten quietly laid photos of seven of the murdered women on the table and asked him if he recognized any of them. McWilliams became visibly agitated and exclaimed, "I don't know any of these whores. I've never seen any of them." In her soft voice, Shorten said, I prefer you call them prostitutes, and I hope someday you'll understand that they too had lives. They didn't deserve to die. Prosecutor Connie Spence wanted to try McWilliams for murder, but worried about the DNA results. She figured the defense could argue that the DNA just proved he had sex with the woman, not that he killed them. They decided to go for a charge of aggravated sexual assault of Chelsea. Chelsea was put in a hotel room to ensure she made it to trial to testify, but she ended up slipping out. Officers searched for her, and she was found in one of her favorite crack houses. She was given a day to sober up and then testified. After she testified, the jury only took 1 hour to convict McWilliams. During the punishment phase, other sex workers testified about what he had done to them. His defense team said nothing a sex worker said could be trusted. However, jurors sentenced McWilliams to life in prison, with a possibility of parole in 30 years. After their multi-year investigation ended, Shorten and Strotter went to eat at Cafe Express near their station. They talked about their children, but inevitably, talk turned to the case. Shorten was very emotional discussing Cynthiana, the woman who had been raped in 2009. She had called Cynthiana to let her know that they had caught McWilliams, who was no doubt her attacker, but her boyfriend answered the phone. He told Shorten that Cynthiana was unable to get over the attack and had hanged herself. The detectives did worry that perhaps the suspect was still out there, since there was no actual evidence tying any of the three suspects to the murders, but they had to go back to life as usual. By the time McWilliams had been arrested, Bilford Dwight Junius and Brian Baby Boy Davis had both been arrested and tried for their respective crimes. Junius, born on September 19, 1970, had been arrested on August 4, 2006. He was charged in the aggravated sexual assault of a woman at 2600 Mansfield. Investigators requested media not share any photos of Junius since it was an ongoing investigation. A 52-year-old Houston woman identified Junius in court as a man who had raped her at gunpoint on August 24, 2003, outside of a vacant house in Acres Homes. In the early morning hours, the victim had walked to the store to get a cup of ice and a pack of cigarettes. As she was returning to the house from the corner store, a previous back injury caused her leg to give out and she fell. Vulnerable and alone, she was relieved to see who she believed was a pizza delivery man stop to assist her. He offered her a ride, and she accepted because he seemed nice. As they drove away, everything seemed fine, and he started taking the correct route home. But he soon changed his route and pointed a gun at the victim. Junius took her to a secluded spot between two vacant houses and said he would not hurt her if she did what he said. He ordered her out of the truck and grabbed her by the neck when she got out. He pinned her to the truck and smashed her head with the truck door. Then he sexually assaulted her, got into his truck, and left. The victim managed to get a phone and call 911. She was taken to a hospital where a sexual assault nurse examiner, or SANE, collected DNA and other evidence. In 2009, 6 years after this attack, Junius was arrested for another offense and his DNA was collected. It was connected to this case and Junius's trial began on April 20, 2009. Before the trial, his attorneys attempted to have his taped interview with police suppressed. During the trial, the victim stated several times that she had feared for her life. She said, "I was praying to God, just let me make it. Let him not kill me. He was so rough. He just had my head in that door, smashing and smashing it." She did state on cross-examination that she had not initially mentioned the gun to police, but she did make a statement about the weapon before the trial. Five other women, all sex workers and crack cocaine users, testified that they were assaulted in a manner similar to the victim. In April 2009, a jury found Bilford Junius guilty in the 2003 sexual assault of a woman in the Acres Home neighborhood. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison. It is believed he was responsible for 8 other attacks in the area. Brian Baby Boy Davis was arrested on April 4, 2008. By the Gulf Coast Violent Offenders Task Force. He was charged with the murder of Candace Yvonne Hightower Sharp, whose badly burned body was found just outside of the city limits. Davis was arrested at the Wells Fargo Bank at Cypress Station in North Harris County because the investigators had information that he was going to get some money and run. Davis completely refused to cooperate with investigators. Davis's ex-girlfriend said that Davis was capable of violence because he had attacked her viciously 2 years before. They had dated for 6 or 7 months, then his girlfriend started pulling away. She was a grad student, and Davis was an unemployed adult living with his mother. A few weeks after they broke it off, Davis came by her apartment and waited to see her. He was kind at first, but quickly became violent, ordering her upstairs, tying her up, and assaulting her for hours. She finally managed to break her binds and jumped from the second-story window to get free. He later said that someone must have slipped him some type of date rape drug because he couldn't remember the attack at all. The charge was initially a felony, but then dropped to a misdemeanor because the prosecution said it would be hard to prosecute since they had been a couple. In February 2010, jurors deliberated for 6 hours before finding Brian Renard Davis guilty of capital murder and the stabbing and burning death of Candace Yvonne Hightower Sharp. Assistant Harris County District Attorney Bill Hawkins said of Candace, "You know she was alive and she burned to death, and she felt that in her last moments as she died by the side of the road." Davis received life in prison without the possibility of parole. LaMarquez McWilliams was charged with 5 counts of aggravated sexual assault and 1 count of murder. Lieutenant Ron Walker of the Houston Police Department Homicide Squad said that similarities in the suspect description, method of sexual assault, and location of the crimes are the reason McWilliams was their prime suspect. McWilliams' attorney, Eric Davis, said his client was unfairly blamed for the Acres Homes murders. In March 2011, McWilliams was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole for 1 charge of aggravated sexual assault. He will be eligible for parole in 30 years. The other rape charges were dismissed. The murder charge was also dismissed against him later in March 2011. Through the multi-year investigation, the task force identified and interviewed 100 potential suspects and made 12 arrests for other violent crimes. Darkus Shorten, a true hero in this investigation, is currently assigned to the Cold Case Unit of the Houston Police Department. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude my episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check Nico out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. This episode was researched by Brittany Martinez and written by Suzanne St. James.